Chapter 15. Save the author. You got problems, I got solutions. Well, folks, we've reached the end of the Save the Cat novel development process. We know what it takes to create story-worthy heroes. We know how to craft 15 compelling story beats that will leave our reader breathless. We've studied the 10 Save the Cat story genres and know what specific elements need to be included in each one. And we're well-versed on how to write a compelling logline and short synopsis. So, how are you feeling? If your answer is a little freaked out, to be honest, don't worry. I've jam-packed a whole novel writing career's worth of wisdom into this book. It's certainly understandable for you to feel a little overwhelmed, which is why I've included this chapter, dedicated entirely to the most frequently asked questions and concerns that I hear from authors implementing the Save the Cat methodology. So let's get you sorted out. Help! Where do I start? The foundation beats. In my Save the Cat workshops, often we'd go through the 15 beats extensively, with explanations and examples and thorough analysis, and at least one student would be staring at me, totally bewildered, when I asked, "What's wrong? Are you still not understanding the A and B story connection? Should we go back and tackle the theme stated again?" The student would continue to stare and blink, and I'd continue to guess at what might be puzzling them, until finally they would be able to put their bafflement into words and say, where do I start? Aha, excellent question. Reason would dictate that you start at the beginning. You tackle your opening image, then you move on to your theme stated, then your setup, and so on. After all, that's the order in which they appear on the beat sheet, and the order in which the reader will read them in the finished novel. Sounds logical, right? But actually, you might be surprised to learn it's not how I tackle the beats. I'll admit, the prospect of coming up with 15 beats is a little bit daunting, which is why I usually start with what I like to call the 5 foundation beats. These beats make up the pillars upon which all the other beats stand. They are also all single-scene beats, so they're easier to tackle up front. These are the directional beats of the story, meaning each of these beats sets a new direction for the plot. Once you establish these beats, the rest of the beats tend to fall into place a bit more naturally, based on the simple mechanics of the beat sheet. The 5 foundation beats are catalyst, break into 2, midpoint, break into 3, all is lost. However, before you tackle any of the beats, figure out the 3 components of your story-worthy hero. A problem, or what makes your hero a flawed hero, a want or goal, and a need. Only when you've got a good idea of who your hero is will you be able to figure out what kind of transformative journey they require. Although everyone is different, and the creative process is unique for each writer, here's how I tackle the beat sheet using these 5 foundation beats. First, I nail down the 3 components of my story-worthy hero: problem, want, and need. This starts to create a picture of what the hero's Act 1 world will look like. Then I work through the following questions. What does the hero's Act 2 world look like? How is it different from Act 1? Is it different enough? This starts to shape my break into 2 beat. How would my flawed hero change the wrong way, based on what they want, not what they need? This continues to shape my break into 2 beat. What kind of major event would be enough to kick this hero out of their status quo and into this strange new world? This forms the catalyst beat. Does my hero generally flounder or excel in this new world? This determines the midpoint and whether it's a false victory, the hero excels in the new world, or a false defeat, the hero flounders in the new world. How does my hero then change the right way, based on what they need? This helps me start to discern my break into three. Finally, what kind of rock bottom, life-changing event would be enough to eventually convince my hero to change the right way? This informs my all is lost beat, which you may recall is usually another catalyst. Help! I need more structure. Using the Save the Cat board. Ah, so you're a structure hound like me, are ya? The beat sheet itself just isn't enough? Like a mouse who's been given a cookie, you gotta have more, do ya? Well, fear not. I got more. I got lots more where that beat sheet came from. I got the board. The Save the Cat board is exactly what it sounds like. A board. A cork board, to be more exact. The biggest you can find at the store. Or if you're more digitally inclined, check out the Save the Cat software at savethecat.com for a virtual board that you can put on your laptop and take with you wherever you may roam. The cork board is then filled with index cards. I recommend the 3x5-inch size, arranged in a particular order to illustrate the Save the Cat beat sheet. It's also a great tool for more visual learners who need to see the beats laid out in front of them. I've found that the board can be super beneficial when you're stuck, while plotting, writing, or revising, to see your story in a new way. Literally. By laying out the beats on the board, you get a better view of the big picture of your story. And as I said in the last chapter, authors tend to struggle with seeing the big picture, especially when they're standing in the middle of the picture, like on page 120, trying to find a synonym for the word face. Trust me, there aren't any good ones. Just use face. Once you have your physical cork board or your Save the Cat software, divide the board into four rows. See figure 3 in the bonus PDF. I like to use masking tape. These rows represent Act 1, Act 2A, the first half of Act 2, Act 2B, the second half of Act 2, and Act 3. Note, the Save the Cat software is already set up this way. Now we start laying out the cards, each representing a scene or chapter in our novel. Each card should reflect one piece of information. So if you write longer chapters that encompass multiple scenes or pieces of information, then you'll have multiple cards per chapter. But don't worry too much about that right now. Just focus on getting your ideas down on cards. For example, if you know your catalyst is going to be that Aunt Clementine gets murdered, that would be one scene or piece of information. And you would create a card that says, Penny finds Aunt Clementine's body. Or if you know that somewhere in your fun and games, you're going to have a scene where Penny interviews Aunt Clementine's butler and discovers he doesn't have an alibi for the night she was killed, you would create a card that says something like, Penny interviews butler, no alibi. Or perhaps you know that a few weeks have to pass between two plot points in the bad guy's close in, and you don't yet know what's going to happen during those weeks, you could create a card that says, 2 weeks pass, ? Remember back in chapter 2, when I told you that some of the beats were single scene beats, like the theme stated, catalyst, and all is lost, and some were multi-scene beats, like the setup, fun and games, and dark night of the soul. Well, when we start to lay out our cards on the board, we see much more of how that comes into play. Take a look at Figure 4 in the bonus PDF to see what the board should look like when it's set up. Wowza! It sure does help to see it all laid out like that, doesn't it? By now, you might be thinking, dang, that fun and games section is long. And you're right. There are a lot of scenes to cover before we reach that exciting, stakes-raising, life-changing midpoint. Which is why the story gods invented B stories and C stories and sometimes even D stories, to fill in those long stretches of pages with something other than the A story. The A story should still be front and center. For instance, if you're writing a murder mystery, then the ups and downs of solving that mystery better make up the majority of those cards. But you can and should give your reader a break from the A story every once in a while and talk about something else for a scene or two. What's going on with the love interest? The best friend? The hero's family? That annoying guy at work? What happened to that email from the ex that the hero found back on page 70? Make sure to give your reader some breathing room between major plot points. It will keep the A story fresh and exciting. Now, it's important to note that the number of cards depicted in Figure 4 in your PDF is by no means the number you're limited to or required to have. That is just an illustration to show you that while the catalyst usually consists of one card or one scene, the setup, debate, fun and games, bad guys close in, dark night of the soul, and finale contain multiple cards or scenes. Your specific number of cards will change depending on the number of pages or words in your novel and how you structure your scenes and chapters. But a general rule of thumb is to have approximately 30 cards for every 25,000 words or 100 pages of story. So for a 75,000-word novel, you might end up with somewhere around 90 cards. However, if you're building the board in the brainstorming phase, I say create as many cards as your awesome little brain can come up with. You can always delete cards later as you start to write. I'm a big fan of the no limits method of brainstorming. If, on the other hand, you're building or updating your board in the writing or revision phase of the novel, chances are you have a target word count or page count goal dictating where your beats go. See the guidelines in Figure 2 of your bonus PDF. And you might have to be a little more strict with your card numbers. But what makes the cork or virtual board so functional is that it's highly adaptable. If you get an aha moment and suddenly figure out that your brilliant bike crash scene belongs not in the fun and games, but rather in the bad guys close in, then presto changeo, just move it. This flexibility is why I recommend cork or virtual boards over writing out scenes on a whiteboard. You can add as much detail or information about the scene as you want on that little index card. And when it's time to move it, all the information goes with it. The board allows you to build and rebuild your story with the touch of a button or relocation of a pin. You can shuffle up your novel whenever you please and see what comes out of the new configuration. Because sometimes all you need is that one simple turn of the kaleidoscope, and suddenly the whole picture comes into focus. Help! I might have more than one main character. A look at novel narratives. After reading chapter 1 of this book, you know that you're supposed to pick one character to be your primary hero of the story. And you might remember I gave the example of Abilene from The Help by Catherine Stockett. Although there are two other characters whose points of view we do see, I still consider her the primary hero of that novel, the one who changes the most. But that doesn't mean that Minnie and Skeeter didn't have their own transformative arcs. They most certainly did. So they also have beat sheets. Check out the breakdown of The Help in Chapter 6 to see how their three beat sheets weave together. So yes, if you're writing a novel with multiple main characters, chances are you're going to need multiple beat sheets, one for each character, in order to track each character's transformative arc throughout the story. I still recommend nailing down your primary hero first, but the best way to juggle multiple arcs is to create multiple beat sheets, and then weave them together to form a compelling narrative. Some beats might overlap. For instance, in The Help, Abilene and Skeeter experience the same break into two beat when Abilene agrees to share her stories with Skeeter. But the two have different catalysts. And Minnie's beats are very separate from Abilene's and Skeeter's until the midpoint, when the storylines converge. On the other hand, you may write a novel with multiple main characters in which none of the beats overlap. This happened to me when I was writing my young adult novel, Boys of Summer. The story is told from the viewpoints of three boys, Grayson, Mike, and Ian. They are best friends who share a very transformative summer on a vacationer's island. But their experiences are quite different. For the most part, they have very different beat sheets. Their only overlapping beat is the All is Lost, which is fitting because it's when they all realize how each of their actions are affecting the others, and this ends up strengthening their friendship. But yes, it means I created three distinct beat sheets, one for each character, before I started writing. And I was constantly juggling those beats as the novel developed and changed. The best way to get good at juggling multiple beat sheets is to study authors who have done it. I recommend finding at least three novels starring multiple protagonists, preferably in the same story genre as the book you're writing, and writing a beat sheet for each one. Study where the beats overlap and where they differ. Take note of how the author interwove the stories together to create their tapestry. Then set out to do the same. So how do you know if you need multiple beat sheets? Well, the best places to look at are your narration and point of view. How many narrators does your novel have? Or if you haven't started writing yet, how many narrators do you plan to have? If you're undecided on this point, the following breakdown might help you decide. Let's look at the various types of novel narratives and see how many beat sheets each one most likely requires. Single first-person narrative. Definition: the novel is told from the direct point of view of one main character, using pronouns like I, me, and my. Examples: The Hunger Games, Prey, The Hate U Give, Ready Player One, The Outsiders, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, The Handmaid's Tale. Beat sheet count: 1. One narrator equals one hero equals one beat sheet. Multiple first-person narrative. Definition: the novel is told from the direct point of view of multiple main characters, usually told through alternating chapters, using pronouns like I, me, and my. Examples: The Help, The Girl on the Train, The Sun is Also a Star by Nicola Yoon, An Ember in the Ashes by Saba Tahir, The Time Traveler's Wife by Audrey Niffenegger, Wonder, All American Boys by Brendan Keeley and Jason Reynolds, Children of Blood and Bone by Tomi Adeyemi. Beat sheet count: multiple, usually one for each narrator. Single third-person narrative limited. Definition: the novel is told from the point of view of an outside narrator, someone not in the story, who has access to only one character's thoughts, using pronouns like he, she, they, hers, his, and so on. Examples: Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, Misery, 1984, The Statistical Probability of Love at First Sight, The Deep, heart-shaped box. Beat sheet count, 1. Whoever's thoughts the narrator has access to. Multiple third-person narrative, limited. Definition: the novel is told from the point of view of an outside narrator, someone not in the story, who has access to multiple characters' thoughts, but only one character at a time, usually told through alternating chapters, using pronouns like he, she, they, hers, his, and so on. Examples: Big Little Lies, Six of Crows, Eleanor and Park, The Da Vinci Code, A Game of Thrones, Far from the Tree by Robin Benway. Beat sheet count, multiple, usually one for each main character whose thoughts the narrator has access to. Third-person narrative omniscient. Definition: usually found in older books, less common today. The novel is told from an outside narrator's point of view, someone not in the story, who has access to everyone's thoughts at once, using pronouns like he, she, they, hers, his, and so on. Examples: Emma, And Then There Were None, Les Miserables, A Christmas Carol, Matilda. Beat sheet count: one or multiple, depending on how many of the characters have significant transformative arcs. Help! I'm writing a series. The series beat sheet. You probably guessed by now that if you're writing a series with multiple novels in it, you're going to need multiple beat sheets, one for each novel. But you'll also need an overarching beat sheet that covers the entire series. This series beat sheet doesn't necessarily need to have all of the 15 beats, but it should track a larger arc for your hero or heroes, one that stretches over the entire series. And it should follow a three-act structure similar to a single-book beat sheet. Think about trilogies, for example. Each book will have 3 acts and 15 beats. But the first book as a whole is often the setup book, depicting an Act 1 world for the series. It brings us and the hero into the story, introduces all of the players, and lets us know what's what. Then it usually ends with a catalyst, a debate, or a choice for the hero, and a break into two, effectively setting up the second book in the trilogy, or the Act 2 book. Then the second book in the trilogy usually ends with an all-is-lost moment, followed by a wallowing dark night of the soul, and finally another decision, a break into three, that leads us to the final installment. And don't third books and trilogies always feel like one giant finale? It's where we find the most epic battles, the most characters lost, the highest stakes, and the greatest victories. So, a series beat sheet for a trilogy might look something like this. Book 1, Series Act 1. Book 2, Series Act 2. Book 3, Series Act 3. This is the way I set up my sci-fi Unremembered trilogy. In Book 1, Unremembered, I introduce my hero, Serafina, who has literally crash-landed in an unfamiliar world, our world. By the end of the first book, I've revealed exactly where Serafina is from and how she happened to arrive in our world. Then in her series Break into Two, the decision that leads to the second book, she escapes our world. By the end of Book Two, Unforgotten, Serafina has had a series All is Lost and a series Dark Night of the Soul, and makes a very fateful and sacrificial decision to return to her world. This is the series Break into Three, which leads us straight into Unchanged, the third book and the series finale, where Serafina finally faces up to people who made her who she is and who have been trying to control her for the entire trilogy. A four-book series or quartet can also be broken down in a similar way. Here is a possible series beat sheet for a four-book series. Book 1, Series Act 1. Book 2, Series Act 2, up until a midpoint twist. Book 3, Series Act 2, up until the break into 3. Book 4, Series Act 3. And yes, while you're doing all of this, you're also juggling character arcs for your hero, one for each novel and one for the series as a whole. Yikes! No one said writing a successful series was easy. All of that strife and torment you deal with when beating out one novel? Well, multiply that times 3, and that's what it's like to plot a successful trilogy. But with a little thoughtful planning and some storytelling ingenuity, it can be done well. And it has been. Let's look at one of the most famous novel series of our time, the Harry Potter series by J.K. Rowling. Each of the 7 novels in the series has an excellent beat sheet in which Harry grows and changes, learning little pieces about himself and his destiny along the way. But the series as a whole also has a transformative journey, as Harry goes from a shy, insecure orphan boy to the mature, confident, magical warrior who fulfills his destiny and defeats Voldemort. Each of the many arcs he experiences in the 7 books adds up to the larger arc of the entire series, which is why he can't just defeat Voldemort in book 1. Rather, he has to temporarily maim him, learning a little something about his own abilities in the process. When you plot a series, every book has to count. You can't have a series with 1 or 2 important novels and a bunch of filler novels. Every book has to have a purpose, a why, a theme stated, and a lesson learned for your hero. And they can't all be the same. Related and interlinked, yes, but not the same. Which is why, as I've mentioned, often not every book in a series will fall into the same genre. As the purpose of each installment will vary, so might the type of story. The Hunger Games, book 1 in the trilogy, is a dude with a problem. It's the story that brings Katniss Everdeen into the system. The choice of how she's going to deal with that system isn't broached until book 2, Catching Fire, which makes it an institutionalized story. Only when she's decided to burn it down can she start coming to terms with being the savior and rebel leader that she's become, making the 3rd book, Mockingjay, a superhero story. 3 books, 3 beat sheets, 3 genres, 1 phenomenal story. And you can do it too. I believe in you. Help! My hero is unlikable. How to save a cat. Back in 2011, when I was writing 52 Reasons to Hate My Father, my young adult novel about a spoiled teen heiress who has to take on 52 low-wage jobs in order to earn her $25 million trust fund, I immediately confronted the likability issue, which many authors have asked me about since. My hero was a filthy rich girl who's never worked a day in her life, grew up traveling the world on yachts, lives in a mansion in Bel Air, drives a $500,000 Mercedes, and, oh yeah, she's an insufferable, spoiled brat. Now that's a character you can root for. Here's the problem. I told you way back in chapter 1 that you need to create a hero who has somewhere to go. Someone with flaws. Someone imperfect. Someone for whom change is a necessity. You gotta back way up on the runway so you have some takeoff room to fly that hero where they need to go. And sometimes, in order to do this, you gotta start with a hero who's less than a peach. But you still have to make sure the reader will stick around to see that transformation take place. So, what do you do? you save a cat. As I mentioned in the introduction, Save the Cat actually started as a fancy writer trick designed to take an unlikable hero and make them a little more likable. It originates from the imaginary scenario that you've got a douchebag of a hero, desperately in need of some de-douchebagging, walking around doing douchebaggy stuff when suddenly he sees a cat stuck up in a tree. He stops. He climbs up in the tree, and he saves the cat, at which point you, the reader, stop and go, "Wait a minute, this guy can't be all bad. He's got a good heart." And voila, now you've got a redeemable, unlikable hero, instead of just an unlikable one. Okay, so you don't literally have to save a cat. It's just an expression that means you need to employ some writerly sleight of hand to convince your reader there's something worth rooting for in your hero. Although I'll admit that in 52 Reasons to Hate My Father, I actually did make the hero's dog an insecure, emotionally damaged rescue. So yes, she quite literally saved a dog. But you don't have to rescue animals to solve your likability problem. You have other options. Give your hero one redeeming quality, action, or hobby. Is your hero meek, bossy, vengeful, whiny, depressed, ungrateful? Nothing can spoil a great setup, like an annoying hero you just want to shake and say, "Snap out of it! Life is not that bad." And that's exactly what you need to do in this situation. You need to make life not that bad. You need to give your hero one little thing that the reader can cling to. Do they have a cute niece, nephew, or neighbor kid who looks up to them? Do they have a secret notebook filled with really bad yet endearing poetry? Do they volunteer once a week at the dog shelter? Give them something that we can latch onto and think, well, at least they've got that. In my young adult novel, The Chaos of Standing Still, the hero, Rin, was struggling to get over the death of her best friend. And let's just say she wasn't exactly a bundle of laughs. When my friend and critique partner, Joanne Rendell, read the first draft, she said, "Well, the story's good, but Rin is kind of a downer. She has no passions, no interests, no hobbies. It's sort of depressing to read. Can't you give her something?" And of course, Joanne was right. Critique partners usually are. So we brainstormed for days, trying to figure out what Rin's thing was. We finally came up with drawing. It was a passion she'd given up after her best friend died, because her grief was clouding her ability to draw things the way she saw them. I was able to talk about her lost passion for drawing and flash back to times when she did draw and it made her happy. I truly believe this small tweak not only fixed my likability issue, but also gave me a cool metaphor to use to show how Rin gets over grief by learning to draw again. Or think about The Hunger Games. Gruff, severe Katniss Everdeen is not exactly warm and inviting when you first meet her. What makes her likable? The fact that she'll do anything for her sister Prim, something we witness on page 22 when she volunteers for the reaping in Prim's place. But even before that, the author gives us so much to love about this tough young girl. Like the fact that she'll break the rules of the capital to feed her sister. Or, don't forget page 1, where Katniss tells us she spared the cat's life because Prim cried when she tried to drown him in a bucket. Save the cat. Give your hero a really bad enemy or situation. Recent studies have shown that reading fiction can make you more empathetic. It gives you X-ray vision into other people's thoughts, feelings, and struggles. It allows you to peek in the windows of other people's lives and see why they are the way they are, a gift we're rarely given in real life. And learning about someone else's struggle can go a long way toward helping us not only understand that person, but sympathize with them as well. Which is why another great way to bring a reader around to an unlikable character is to pit them against an even less likable character. A villain, a nemesis, a complicated best friend, even a horrible parent can do the trick. Once we see how horrible that person is, we no longer can bear to hate the hero. Instead, we understand the hero. We think, well, no wonder they're so horrible. Look what they have to put up with. Understanding why a person is the way they are helps us sympathize with that person. It's a lesson in empathy that I think we can all stand to learn these days. What makes someone act the way they do? What horrors is this person living with? Although in real life, we can't always go behind closed doors and find out, we can certainly do it in fiction. And we should. In The Kite Runner by Khaled Hosseini, we're introduced to the hero Amir. Let's face it, Amir isn't very nice to his best friend Hassan. In fact, he's just plain awful to him most of the time. Why do we root for this character? Why do we keep turning the pages to find out what will happen to him? Because of his father. We get a peek at what Amir's life is like, his struggle to win the affections of his seemingly cold-hearted father, his desperation to prove to his father that he's not the worthless son his father thinks he is. And that is enough. We don't forgive Amir for the things he does to Hassan, at least not until the end. But we can start to sympathize and understand his actions a little bit better. I used this same parental trick in 52 Reasons to Hate My Father. Actually, the trick is in the title. Lexington Larrabee is pretty horrible, but wait until you meet her dad. He's seemingly unloving, uncaring, and never around. No wonder she acts like such an irresponsible brat. She's trying to get her father's attention. A similar way to accomplish this same task is to put your hero in a bad situation, or at the very least, explain their situation. Emma Woodhouse in Emma by Jane Austen lost her mother at a very young age. No wonder she's so wary of attachment. Rachel in The Girl on the Train was cheated on by her husband with a woman he went on to marry and have a child with. No wonder she drinks. Jean Valjean went to prison for 19 years for stealing a loaf of bread. No wonder he's been hardened and turned against society. Even the infamous Ebenezer Scrooge has a reason for how he turned out. He was kicked out of his house by his father when he was a boy. No wonder he has such trouble empathizing with others. Characters are never unlikable for no reason. They don't emerge that way from the womb. We all start as a blank slate. So what was drawn on that slate to turn the hero into the person we meet on page one of the book, giving us a glimpse of their past, their parentage, and/or their present situation, can really help us wrap our head around who this person is and why they are the way they are. And once we get a firm grasp on the why, we can start sympathizing with the hero's plight to fix it. Help! I'm stuck. Some parting words of wisdom and inspiration. There's no such thing as writer's block. There, I said it. If you're awake, you can write. If you can sit down in a chair, you can write. If you have fingers, you can write. I didn't say the writing was going to be any good, but you're never actually blocked from writing. You can always write something. Regardless of what stage you're at, you will get stuck in this process. I guarantee it. You will have good days and bad days. You will write scenes you love and scenes you throw away. You will change your catalyst beat a million times until you come up with the right one. You will get to the end of the novel and realize your fun and games is all wrong. It's called a creative process for a reason. But that doesn't mean I'm going to end this book without giving you some helpful tips for dealing with that process. So, here's what I got for you. Give yourself permission to write or plot badly. There's no such thing as writer's block or plotter's block. There's only perfectionist's block. Thank you to author Emily Hainsworth for this brilliant, brilliant phrase. We're terrified that what we write or plot will be horrible. Well then, just give in to that fear and let it be horrible. Write something horrible. Plot out a dreadful, disgusting, cringe-worthy beat sheet. Let yourself suck. Here's a little secret for you. If you write something horrible, no one but you ever has to read it. And you can always go back and fix it later. Nora Roberts says, "You can't fix a blank page." And how true is that? Write something bad so future you has something to fix. Otherwise, future you will be very bored and disappointed that past you didn't live up to your end of the bargain and put something down on that page. Don't disappoint future you. Don't put future you out of a job. Write something awful and let future you deal with it. That's what future you does best. So don't be afraid to write badly. Embrace the bad. Or as I like to say, don't be afraid to write crap. Crap makes great fertilizer. Be flexible. Beats will change. Whether you're a plotter or a pantser, whether you spend days, weeks, months, or even years drafting your beat sheet and making sure every single detail is figured out before you start writing, or you simply jot down a few ideas and hit the page, either way, your beats will change. It's inevitable. You may get to the final page of your novel and realize that your setup is all wrong. You may be halfway through your first draft, or even your final draft, and realize your all is lost needs to come way earlier, or be way more devastating. Your beats are not carved in stone, nor should they be. Author Terry Pratchett says, "The first draft is just you telling yourself the story." In fact, some people even call the first draft the discovery draft, because that's what you're doing. You're discovering the story. You're exploring the world. You're getting to know the hero. Plotting a novel and thinking you can stick to everything you planned is about as delusional as plotting your life and thinking nothing will ever go astray. Yes, hammering out your 15 beats in advance can certainly help you figure out where you want to go with the story, and will probably even set you in the right direction. But it won't ever help you figure out exactly how to get there. Writing a novel is a golden fleece. The daunting white page or screen you face every day is your road. The end is your prize. I and your critique partners and fellow writers are your team. And there will be detours along the way. There will be road apples that stop your journey cold and force you to reroute, re-beat. Be flexible and let your beats change as your story and your hero come more and more into focus. And when you get lost, remember to come back to your wants and needs. They are your signposts on this journey. As you drive toward the midpoint, keep your sights on what your hero wants. And then as you drive toward the final image, keep your sights on what the hero needs. These two things will help guide you through the dark spots on the road. Don't compare your work in progress to someone else's finished masterpiece. As you study the beat sheets in this book, and you set out to analyze other novels and find the patterns in them, keep in mind that these are finished products, not works in progress. They represent months, sometimes even years of struggle. Not to mention countless revisions, editorial letters, copy edits, and professional proofreads. It's hard not to compare ourselves to the great works we find on our shelves. Because what else do we have to compare ourselves to? It's not like any of our favorite authors are posting their messy, hideous, rough drafts on their website for all to see. But I guarantee you, they exist. Those authors have them. We all have them. Novels don't spill onto the page in finished form. Usually, at least for me, they spill onto the page as grotesque, misshapen Rorschach test images that I have to squint and tilt my head at for hours on end to attempt to make any sense of. And along the same lines, try not to compare your beat sheet in progress to any of the beat sheets featured in this book. Remember, those are analyses of stories that are already finished and perfected. I can guarantee you, they don't resemble anything like the outline the author started with when they first sat down to write, if they even started with an outline. This is what I call the difference between a before beat sheet and an after beat sheet. A before beat sheet is what we plotters create before we start writing. A roadmap for our story to help us stay on target to our destination. An after beat sheet is an analysis of a finished, completed, revised, edited, copy edited, proofread novel to study the patterns in the story. To illustrate how different these two beat sheets can be, and how much a beat sheet can change as you write the novel, I've included before and after beat sheets for my novel, The Geography of Lost Things, in the bonus PDF that came with this audiobook. Read it and you'll see how sparse the before beat sheet is, how many holes there still are, how little I had figured out before I started writing, and how much the beats changed as I spent more time with the story and the characters. In the after beat sheet, you'll notice many of the beats have moved, while others are just more fleshed out, and some beats were rewritten altogether. So be kind to yourself. You won't have it all figured out at the very start. Or even if you do, as I said before, it most likely will change. Final image. I have no idea what in this book will resonate with you and what won't. What will help you through your own writing dark night of the soul, and what you simply skimmed over. That's why I put everything I have into these pages, over a decade of story wisdom, hoping that something you hear will not only stick, but also serve to transform. Yes, it is my sincerest hope that you finish this book as not only a better writer, but a changed person. What flaws did you uncover in yourself? What imperfections did you perfect? What wants did you abandon in service to your more worthy needs? You, my friend, are the true hero of this story. You are the reason I wrote this book. Right now, yours is the only transformation that matters to me. So go out there and be the storytelling superhero that I know you're destined to be.